Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're checking in with Katie Masouris of HackerOne. She's an ex-Microsoftie who's spent something like a decade working on vulnerability disclosure policies. She even helped get a vulnerability disclosure ISO standard ratified. So yes, very much a vuln disclosure person, and she will be joining us this week to discuss disclosure politics, I guess you'd call it. For those of us who've been around InfoSec for a while, most of us would rather stick our face in a blender than talk more about this, but Katie will be along to point out why people should fight their disclosure debate fatigue and actually get involved. This week's show is brought to you by Telstra. Big thanks to them. Telstra is Australia's incumbent telco, but also offers a bunch of enterprise services and has invested in some mobile security plays. They've taken a stake in Zimperium, which is where Risky Business pal Joshua Drake, aka J-Duck, works. They also have a stake in Telesign. So in this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Telstra's Rocky Scovoletti. He's Telstra's finance brain, and he'll be along to discuss a report he prepared on the fusion of financial services, mobility, and identity. Telstra has collected a lot of extremely interesting data, and Rocky will be along to fill us in on what it all means a little bit later on. That is this week's sponsor interview, with big thanks to new sponsor, Telstra. But before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good pal, Adam Boileau. And Adam, for the second time in as many weeks, we're going to lead this week's news segment with news of some jumbo data breaches. We've got 15 million T-Mobile subscribers losing some data courtesy of Experian, which is, you know, irony points there.
Yeah, totally.
Scottrade losing, they're a brokerage in the United States, losing 4.6 million customer records. And Donald Trump's hotel chain getting breached as well. And I'm just kind of sad that there's so many other breaches, because otherwise we could single him out and be mean, but it's just business as usual in 2015, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it really is. It is. It's just free credit monitoring for everybody. Of course, that's particularly funny when it's in the credit bureaus that are themselves getting owned and leaking data, as in the case of Experian. Although, let's face it, 15 million customers compared to the size of the that guy from Vietnam who just like bought legit service off Experian and then used it for on selling to criminals, which was like 200 million people. Yeah, small bickies compared to that. But yeah, it's been quite a week for breaches.
Well, what does a credit monitoring firm give people when they lose their records? That's what I'm wondering. Yo, dog, I heard you liked giving away credit. I don't know. There's got to be an exhibit meme in there somewhere. You'd think. Oh, and, you know, some other breach-related news. Patreon, however you want to say it, was apparently warned of, you know, their impending pwnage about 5 days before they came and announced. No news really on whether or not that's what spurred them to investigate and then announce the breach.
No, there isn't any suggestion that the two were immediately related, although the details of exactly how they got breached in this case are hilarious.
No, I know. It's a real, like, slap your forehead. Someone told me that that was how they got owned via Twitter, and I thought it was a joke. Like, I thought they were actually kidding. But, Adam, how did Patreon get owned?
So they the development website that they had left on the internet by mistake was running a plugin that when the web app threw an error, dropped you into like a debug manhole. So like it had some essentially a Python command prompt on the website, which you could just kind of type stuff into and it would run it in the context of the app on the server side. And so, yeah, someone triggered the this debugger thing to launch and just typed in some code and owned the box, which is a wonderful bug.
Yeah, well, it's not so much a bug, really. I mean, this is just
it's a
dev feature, but I mean, how on earth? And apparently, it's quite common. I think Shodan found it, right? And if you go to Shodan and look for this thing, the WorkZug debugger, you'll find plenty of test sites that have it enabled, which shouldn't be on the internet.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's a wonderful, hilarious, amusing feature. But yeah, remote code execution by design. You know, what more could you ask for?
Let's just put our RAM on the internet. You know, what could go wrong? What could go wrong? And yeah, 15 gig of Patreon-related data has been dumped, apparently.
Yeah, so we've seen some, Tarball doing the rounds, which had a bunch of data extracted from their box. What's interesting, of course, is that this Tarball has a bunch of source code in it and some database dumps. I mean, clearly it was a dev site that was, had copies of prod data from a point in time, for use for development. But what's interesting is I thought that the current live Patreon is a PHP app. And this one's Python, so I think it seems likely that this is the new one that they're in the middle of developing, which of course they're trying to, I imagine, test with production data, so they've got the right sort of scale and things. But yeah, so whether or not it's useful for them hacking onwards into their current production infrastructure is a good, interesting question to come out of this. But that's what.
Well,
it looks
like. I'm guessing Patreon's security budget just went up a few tiers.
I imagine so.
Yeah. So now, look, moving over to an interesting, intriguing, you might say, breach story. There's been a bit of brouhaha between Uber and Lyft. So Uber apparently had a bunch of information on its drivers hacked, and now they're going to court to subpoena Comcast to find out who the subscriber of a certain IP is, because apparently that IP revealed itself to have access to some secret crypto keys that it shouldn't have had. But what's really interesting is Uber is kind of alleging that that IP is the personal IP of the CTO of Lyft.
Yeah, it's an interesting, corporate espionage twist. They uploaded, originally Uber uploaded one of their crypto keys to GitHub, which, dumb move. Of course, that got them used to steal a bunch of their data. And yeah, the GitHub logs, they got GitHub to supply IP addresses of who'd accessed it, ruled out pretty much everything else and left a couple of Comcast IPs, and then through some other searching, identified it as being likely belonging to this guy who's now CTO of the competition, which... IPs don't necessarily equal people. Of course, Lyft
have
denied anything. But your competitor accidentally leaves, a very important, commercially sensitive bit of data lying around the internet. You might go and have a look. Certainly Ashley Madison's CTO appeared to be on the same, from the same school of thought.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Pretty cutthroat, right?
There's history here, though, between Uber and Lyft. I mean, they'd accused each other of putting in a bunch of bogus trips into each other's systems to try to tie up resources and subvert each other. So there's a lot of bad blood and fierce competition between these two companies.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you would certainly imagine that in that context, you would take advantage of a mistake by your competitor. So it'll be interesting to see whether, once this gets through the court process of getting the data out of Comcast, whether or not it does point the finger at the CTO of Lyft.
Some industry news now, and Amazon has made a whole bunch of PCI people very, very unhappy.
Yeah, Amazon has released this tool called Inspector, which is like a security scanner for hosted services in Amazon, so EC2 and the rest of their web services product set. It's pretty new. I haven't actually had a chance to look at it. One of our guys was kind of tasked to go have a play with it and figure out what it's useful for. But yeah, it does compliance scanning, of your virtual machine instances using a combination of what it knows about your infrastructure by virtue of having access to your Amazon account and some kind of host-based config review sort of stuff of the boxes, the virtual machines that you're running. I don't know how good it is yet. Certainly for a lot of people who are running stuff in the cloud and any live scale, they're not going to do any security testing. So having anything at all that they can point and click and run from inside their Amazon control panel would be a really good thing.
Well, look, I've heard it's actually pretty good, right? And it's going to invalidate some of the dumber PCI auditing services. So that's got to be good.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think this is great. I mean, anything that can... take care of the automatable stuff leaves, those of us who do this kind of work for a living able to concentrate on things that humans are better on finding and better at reviewing and add, human intelligence to the process and leave the stuff that's automatable to, computers, right? So no, I think this is good. I mean, we'll have a play with it. And, I think even personally, I've reviewed a couple of big systems that are deployed in AWS in the last couple of months. This is an area that is ripe for innovation in the toolchain department because there's so much Amazon specific stuff that Amazon are the best equipped to help you understand and secure. So yeah, this is good.
Yep. And we've had another talk pulled from a conference. This one was looking at IP cameras and was pulled from Hack in the Box GSEC Singapore.
This was a talk by a guy from Ptrace Security in Switzerland, which apparently was going to drop, you know, three different vendors worth of IP camera bugs, which, I mean, let's face it, no one is surprised about there being being bugs, you know, presumably auth bypass in IP cameras. But yeah, he was going to drop a bunch of them. He hasn't talked about exactly who the vendors are. He told the vendors whoever they are, they aren't happy. Well, yeah, apparently he gave them the details of the bugs, and that was all fine. And then he said, oh, and I'm going to talk about it at this conference. Do you want to review the slides? And everything got a bit more tense after that, and the legal department's involved. Anyway, so he voluntarily pulled the talk just because he said he didn't want to, you know, kind of impinge on the career prospects of other people he worked with on the same project.
Well, and he's probably got better things to do than spend all that time and money in court too, right?
Well, exactly right. I mean, it's not worth it for a, you know, for a con talk. I mean, if you really want to drop the bugs, then, you know, that's what Tor and Anonymous
maybe someone else happens to find them and anonymously post them to full disclosure.
Which would totally never happen.
Funnily enough, though, you know, I've had a bunch of people going, oh, well, who cares? They're just junk cameras anyway. And it's like, we don't know that, man. I mean, I've had demos from some pretty heavyweight vendors with their IP cameras. I mean, I'm talking about the companies that supply airports with their gear. And I'm looking at it and I'm looking at the interfaces and I'm like, you know, this all looks a little bit creaky. It all looks a little bit old. There's probably a lot of fun to be had.
Yeah, and I mean, IP cameras are quite a valuable thing to compromise. I mean, I've hacked a few of them in my time, and being able to, you know, see people type in PIN numbers on doors, you know, on combination locks on doors, or type things on their keyboard, or read whiteboards remotely, or even reading the labels on racks remotely is really useful stuff. I mean, this, you know, IP cameras.
Or just getting drunk and freaking people out in boardrooms. That's a fun one. Well, but that's more video conferencing than video cameras.
Yeah, but no, they're you know, they're not complete junk hacking. They have certainly real purposes in you know, using for other things. I mean, certainly we've seen some very strong cases of attribution of hackers where people have owned their laptops, you know, owned the person doing the hacking and then taken screenshots out of the webcam and, you know, attributed who was actually doing it. So, yeah, no, these are real, you know, cameras are real things. So,
yeah, well,
Full disclosure, God damn it.
Oh, now, some time ago we spoke about this Verizon identifier that they insert into, like, headers. So every time you're browsing a clear text site through HTTP, it adds like a unique identifier, and then Verizon on-sells this data to advertisers. They're still at it. I mean, you know, SSL invalidates this, so any connection you're using via SSL, you know, it's not a problem. But still, now they're even doing deals with AOL's ad network, and you just think, geez, Verizon using some sort of weird perma-cookie header thing in conjunction with AOL? Like, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah, exactly. It's such a jerk move. But I mean, I guess, you know, if we were talking about advertising is what pays everyone's bills these days. So I guess if it makes the advertising better, by that logic, it's probably fine. But it just, we're just going to have to SSL the entire internet, so all this shit just kind of goes away.
Well, Let's Encrypt is tracking pretty good, so, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing that is going to make a real difference. You know, when that has rolled out, we'll start to see people, you know, just by default having SSL on everything new deployed, and, you know, everyone's Amazon images will automatically do it, and, you know, the world will just become a better place, and, you know, Verizon and AOL can both go themselves.
Exactly. I will be relaunching risky.biz next year, actually, and doing a bit of a site redesign and stuff. And it, yeah, I plan to SSL by default everything, which is just, you know, the current box is so creaky. Please no one try to hack it. You'll find it very easy. So yeah, we're gonna try to get on that next year. Moving on. And I got to pop up today in the Sydney Morning Herald. Ben Grubb, a technology reporter there, just asked me for a couple of quotes on this story about our new Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. He's apparently using his own email server, right? So the Australian press is sort of drawing some parallels between, you know, Hillary Clinton and Malcolm Turnbull both operating these, you know, these private mail servers that may not necessarily be secured well. And it actually got me thinking, like my quotes were sort of along the lines of, well, you know, the difference here, because the Department of Prime Minister has said, well, okay, so he can't security tag, you know, put security tags on messages, but it's not handling classified info, so it doesn't matter. And I'm like, well, you know, his box isn't going to be complying with the ISM, which is the ASD's mandated standards for federal government systems. And, you know, that box will be a target of all sorts of people. So, you know, maybe ASD should have a look at it. But then I think, do we really want taxpayer money being spent on securing politicians' private things? And from there, I thought, well, maybe parliamentarians and politicians should get some sort of allowance for ASD to be able to look at their personal stuff. Do you think that's something that we should consider in 2015?
Well, I think so. I mean, you have to consider the real-world threat model here, right? I mean, if the Prime Minister has got, personal email services, personal IT services, of course they're a target of nation-state adversaries as well as everybody else, right, who wants to have a go and have some lols or whatever. And that's just the reality of the situation, right? And it makes sense to accept that and deal with it. I mean, you know, certainly when you get a politician like that, I imagine that they have physical security people go and check out the house, right, and take care. And that, you know, it's taxpayer dollars being spent because of the real-world threat model. It seems to make sense that you would extend that to IT as well. I mean, politicians go home in the evening and, you know, use their iPhones and, you know, play Angry Birds like everybody else, I'm sure. So let's accept it and you know, deal with the problem holistically. Because let's face it, having, you know, turnbull.com.au hosted on some, you know, common garden ISP's name servers like everybody else with single-factor auth to their control panel, like, that's just not a thing that you want to deal with being owned, you know? So,
yeah, well, I mean, it's funny too, because he's into his tech, this guy, right? So he helped set up Aussie Mail, which was a very large early Australian ISP. You know, he wears an Apple Watch to Parliament, right? So that's that's Turnbull, and he's glued to his smartphone all the time. And I kind of think, well, if you could own his SMTP box, like, you know, I don't know, man, you might find some vectors into his other devices through that server. So I'm wondering at what point it becomes in scope, and it's got to be a policy nightmare for the ASD guys, right?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, right, the adversaries don't give a f*** what's in scope, right? They can do whatever works, and the defenders can either deal with the reality or, you know, sit there worrying about scope, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. So, yeah, I'll be curious to have a couple of beers with some of those Canberra guys and see what they think about it when I head off to RuxCon in a couple of weeks. Now, a bunch of backdoors have been affecting Cisco VPNs, allowing attackers to steal a bunch of passwords. I mean, I just looked at this story and it really reminded me of Alex Stewart Merck's talk down in Melbourne at Rux, I think it was last year or the year before, on owning Cisco stuff through their awful, awful, awful web interfaces. It seems that, like, every time Cisco write, you know, web apps, they're awful. I mean, they're really bad.
Like, this particular story on ours is about a botnet or, you know, fairly large-scale compromiser of Cisco VPN concentrators. It's using Alex Stewart Merck's bug.
Oh, it is.
Like, it's not a new bug. He dropped the code for that. He dropped the Metasploit module for it sometime after Rux and KiwiCon last year.
Oh, I didn't put that together. Yeah, I was just like, this looks very similar.
Yeah, well, it is. It's the exact. Well, I mean, he dropped five or six bugs in that talk. It was an amazing talk.
Yeah, it was.
Where he reverse engineered Cisco ASA SSL VPN. Well, Cisco ASA is in particular the SSL VPN endpoint. But no, that was a particular bug where you can update the login screen theming pre-auth over the internet. So you just replace it with something which steals the steals the creds and steals the session token, which means you can bypass two-factor auth and then onwards into the rest of the network. So, yeah, someone's been weaponizing and owning all sorts of shit because nobody patches their ASAs because, you know, it's just network kit, not a computer or something. But, yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's a good case study of a hacker dropping a bug at a con and then how long and how bad before it actually, you know, starts getting weaponized by bad people.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a year, you know, I'm just looking at it now. Yeah. You're right, it was his bugs and they were patched over a year ago. And it's like, guys, come on.
Yeah. I mean, when we booked that talk for KiwiCon, I actually scheduled it directly before the morning tea break so that everyone in the audience could go and phone their ops guys and tell them to patch. Because, nobody patches their ASAs.
No. Oh, staying with Cisco, and they've actually done something useful. They actually managed to pull down a... You know, those ransomware botnet things. So these guys were using the Angler exploit kit to drop, crypto ransomware on people. And some researchers at Cisco got curious and wound up rolling the whole thing up.
Yeah, they managed to figure out who was hosting one of the command and control servers, talk to the hosting provider, get access to that box through the hosting provider, pull the logs, figure out how it's working, and then shut it down. And they, from looking at the logs, they estimated something like $30 million a year was what the take of this particular crew using this particular deployment of Angler was, which is, you know, that's not small bickies.
SHA-1, get the hell away from SHA-1 because, you know, we've been saying for some years now that it's got a best before date and it looks like we're pretty much there now. We have been maybe even for a little while.
Yeah, some researchers put together a paper describing their work on starting towards, you know, proper collisions of SHA-1. They haven't got to the point where they've got a full, you know, chosen prefix SHA-1 attack working, but they've got kind of an intermediate step that puts them ahead of the estimated curve. I mean, they were comparing it to Schneier's numbers about, you know, how long it would take before SHA-1 was realistically collidable, and the anticipation was it'd be a couple $100,000 in about 2017. They're currently tracking ahead of that with their current GPU-based process. which is, you know, it's good work and, you know, sort of the logical, you know, way things are these days, right, of each of the hashing algorithms gradually falling down. But unfortunately, they're calling this thing the Shappening, like the SHA-happening, which is continuing the tradition of awful names for security bugs in the last couple of years.
Oh, now quell surprise, because a bunch of researchers from the UK international affairs think tank Chatham House have actually looked at the design of nuclear reactors and found, and here's the really, really surprising, amazing, counterintuitive part, their computer systems aren't particularly secure.
Well, I know. I am dead of shock and horror.
Yeah.
Who knew industrial control systems connected to, I don't know, other things would be bad? Well, indeed, they are bad. Even in the case of a nuclear reactor, and of course, the collision of cultures between, you know, engineering driven in the style of nuclear people and IT people who just want to patch everything all the time constantly doesn't really go well together. So it's even worse than every other industrial application.
Yeah, well, I mean, this report says they're insecure by design. And, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, and I'm sure some listeners have, that I don't really spend a lot of time talking about ICS-related news in the show because, you know, it took me a while to understand that industrial control systems and SCADA systems, you know, they don't have any security in them. So when you're hearing about these patches for ICS controllers and stuff, I mean, really, once you're on the network, you own the network. There is no auth there.
Yes, absolutely right. If you get anywhere near control systems, networks, that's you've just done. And even the ones that do have security, it's manufacturer default or it's like a four-digit PIN or, you know, there's just no – it's not architected for security. The products aren't designed to be secure. There's no security boundary. It's just one nuclear power plant and you let someone in with a USB stick and you're going to have a bad time.
You keep saying nuclear. That's funny. Oh, here's a funny one, actually. It took me, like, reading this a couple of times to get why it was – well, I still don't really understand – how this is possible, but there's this weird behavior involving Microsoft where your unique like CID identifier winds up leaking via DNS. Like, can you just explain this to me? What is going on here?
So Microsoft on one of their cloud platforms, OneDrive, Outlook, there's a unique identifier that relates to your user account, and they use they have individual like dynamic DNS for customers. So you have a DNS record relating to your customer ID, which is like, you know, CID, your number, .storage.live.com, for example. And as part of using the app, it actually talks to that endpoint.
So then you obviously need to do a domain name lookup involving your CID, right?
Your browser does a DNS lookup and onwards. And of course, DNS lookup is not inside SSL, it's DNS. And then, you know, that then discloses to people who are sniffing your connection. Or if you're going across Tor, for example, where your DNS is coming out of a Tor endpoint, then people can see what your ID is, and then from that resolve back to your, you know, user ID and account and name and picture and profile information from Microsoft Online Services, which is just kind of a weird design choice, I guess. And the side effects of that are that it leaks stuff kind of outside of where you would normally expect, which is, I mean, you should see a TLS tunnel. But of course, also it uses...
Well, I mean, NSA could very reliably collect a database of who's using Tor.
We talked last week about the GCHQ's program to, you know, tie everyone together using exactly this kind of identifier. Like, this is the sort of, you know, strong selector that they really love, and is a wonderful boon for people who are tracking everything.
I wonder how many SIGINT agencies weren't doing this and now they've seen the story and they're like, oh shit, we should have been doing that. You know?
Yes, well, you should get onto it then, SIGINT agencies who are listening to the show, because apparently Microsoft are thinking about it, and whether or not they change anything will remain to be seen.
Well, but yeah, you know, it is a design choice, right? And you'd think actually reversing that's going to be a pretty major league undertaking.
Yes, yeah, but it's not a trivial fix, right? You have to change how this works presumably quite fundamentally.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure how it was winding up in a DNS query. I didn't realize it was a subdomain, but there you go. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, Android. There is some adware for Android, which uses a bunch of, like, you know, pretty nasty exploits. I think there's 8 of them in this thing. So once you install a malicious app, which just gets served up to you from a website, like, hey, download this app, and it's dressed up as, you know, legit apps, you install it, then it gets root on your phone, and it just stays there forever and throws ads at you all the time, which is, like, pretty benign by, you know, 2015 standards. At least it's not stealing all your information, but it's like, holy crap, man, these ad guys using 8, you know, exploits to just totally root your phone, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, it is. And I, you know, just go show how well the ad ecosystem, you know, incentivizes content delivery or something like that, right? Or maybe it just suggests that Android exploits are so cheap and easy to use that even advertisers can do it. But this is just, I guess fairly common garden ad farming malware that just happens to use a bunch of bugs to own the phone. And of course, just factory resetting your Android phone doesn't get rid of it because they live in the bit that doesn't necessarily get factory reset. So yeah. It's a pretty nasty thing for, the billion or so people who are running vulnerable Android phones.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to dig around with it a lot to flatten it to the extent that you remove it. So, not a whole heap of fun. Wired has an interesting sort of think piece up written by Andy Greenberg just about lessons learned from the iPhone malware hitting China, this sort of supply chain infiltration thing. So I've dropped a link to that in this week's show notes. People might want to check that out. Meanwhile, you remember there was that journalist who worked for, I think it was the LA Times. He used to work for Reuters. His name's Matthew Keyes. This is a guy who handed off creds to Anonymous and said, go own our website. It'll be funny. Yay. And so they did. They defaced one page. And of course, he lost his job. I believe he's been convicted and he's facing sentencing. But he's looking at an absolute, massive sentence for this, which is crazy.
It is. He's looking apparently a sentence of up to 25 years for handing off his creds to somebody else who then used them, for not particularly serious hacks. Like they added a story about Tupac or something to the LA Times, right? It really wasn't world-ending stuff. And yet 25 years just seems crazy.
No, it is. It's nuts. I mean, he hasn't received that sentence yet. But, surely the appropriate punishment for something like this is you lose your job, you go to court, the court says, turn your life around there, guy. And then you leave, you pay a $2,000 fine and then you leave. I mean, I don't think the guy is going to be doing it again. I mean, his employment prospects are probably screwed. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't see what good there will be in putting this guy in prison for 25 years. Do you really need that as a deterrent? The guy's life is ruined.
Well, exactly. And he confessed to it all. He cooperated with the police right from the beginning. There's no on the run for 5 years, Kevin Mitnick style, whistling nuclear bomb strikes. I mean, really not, as you say, no real deterrent is required here.
That this guy has become an activist cause, though. Do you know what I mean? Because ultimately what he did was really stupid and criminal and deserving of punishment. And some people are dressing it up as, oh, look, they're trying to put a journalist in prison. It's like, yeah, because he did something really illegal.
I mean, if you tell Anon, you give Anon creds something and say, quote, go some shit up, unquote.
Yeah.
Then,
you can expect really to go to court and it is not just the man trying to manipulate the media,
Yeah.
That is legit. Now WikiLeaks is doing something interesting at the moment. They are putting out a $50,000 reward for very specific data. So they really are putting out a bounty for data that the only way someone could get it to them is by breaking the law, which is, it's got to be a legally incredibly risky strategy. I mean, but then again, the guy's already living in an embassy, right? So
what are you
gonna
do, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how much worse it can get for him, but they want cockpit footage and internal audio from the AC-130 gunship that attacked that hospital in Afghanistan. So it'll be interesting to see if they get it. But I mean, I for one would be very curious to hear that conversation in the cockpit myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could certainly make a very convincing argument this is in the public interest. Mm. But on the other hand, WikiLeaks have always said, we're just a journalist organization. We accept anonymous submissions, but we don't solicit it. I'm pretty sure this counts as soliciting it. Like when you're putting specific dollar bounties on specific pieces
of information. Well, they solicited the stuff from Manning as well. They weren't offering money, but they actually had a hit list, which was legally problematic. I believe that might be one of the issues that they may face, is that they did say, this is what we're after. So this is true to form. But what I find interesting is it's incentivizing, it's putting a bounty on a specific bit of data. And you just sort of wonder, I mean, I don't think 50K is going to be enough to motivate someone in the US military to leak this to them. And in fact, I think when you identify the information that you're after, what it means is a bunch of goons from the Pentagon immediately start putting rings around that data. Do you know what I mean? Like, this footage is going to be buried because of this WikiLeaks bounty offer. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it once you publicize having a target list like this, then absolutely the defenders are going to change their behavior to take that into account. I mean, you've increased the likelihood that a particular thing is going to happen, then, all of the risk people will adjust their risk ratings and corresponding behavior will change, I'm assuming.
I'm guessing this data is going to be put on a USB key and carried around internally by a bunch of Navy SEALs.
Yeah, well,
that will be the way it will be stored. in a very tight, well-protected place.
I don't know. It's just an interesting development, isn't it, of this kind of specific data boundaries. And if we started to see this on a really large scale, it's kind of like assassination lotteries for data, I suppose, which is a... I don't know. I guess we do live in the dystopic cyberpunk future.
Yes. Well, you got to say it again. That's awesome.
I did. Every week I get to say it because we do.
Because we do. And before we go, mate, Adobe is patching Reader and Acrobat next week. Now, normally I wouldn't mention an upcoming Adobe patch, but, you know, I am about to go on holiday for 2 weeks. So...
you got to prepare for the horrible things that are going to happen.
Get ready for the Cybergeddon. Yes. I will be probably in Bangkok on Monday, Tuesday, sipping champagne with the Gruk as the internet burns.
Well, it's far better place to be than many, I'm sure.
So, yeah, just watch out. Get your Adobe patches up, yeah. All right, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. And, I'll chat to you when I'm back. I'm taking 2 weeks off, then I'm going to Rux. And, I'll catch you. Are you going to be at RuxCon?
No, I'm not going to make it. There's a bunch of other dudes from Somnia are heading over, I am unfortunate. It's the first RuxCon I've ever missed, actually. I've been to all of them until now.
Yeah, wow.
But no, the QEcon organizing train is all aboard, unfortunately.
Okay, pal. Well, I will chat to you when I'm back, on deck, which will, I guess we all next chat in about 3 weeks.
All right. Well, have a nice holiday and I'll talk to you afterwards.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Katie Masouris. She is an ex-Microsoftie, but these days she works for bug bounty firm HackerOne. I wanted to talk to Katie because she's been involved in vulnerability disclosure politics for a very, very long time. She was instrumental in getting an ISO standard for vulnerability disclosure ratified, and she launched bug bounties at Microsoft, which really helped kick off that whole industry sector, which I suppose is why it makes sense that she works for HackerOne now. But you may ask, why would I want to talk about vulnerability disclosure ethics on this show? I mean, it's been done to death, right? Well, it's my feeling, and the feeling of a lot of other people, that the security research community's reluctance to get involved in this tired old debate is how we wound up with something as crackheaded as the Wassenaar arrangement, covering exploit controls on, things like exploits and vulnerability information. Now, I know some countries have done better jobs than others in implementing Wassenaar regulations, but they're still less than ideal. So when I caught the news that the US National Telecommunications and Information Administration, or the NTIA, was convening meetings on this topic, I thought two things. Firstly, oh God, not this again. And secondly, even though we're sick of this discussion, maybe we shouldn't ignore it this time. If people who understand this issue don't pipe up, decisions will be made for them, just like they were with Wassenaar. Now, the NTIA isn't a body that will enact laws or regulations on this stuff, but it is still a US government department, so any report or finding that it arrives at will likely inform policy. That means researchers need to engage with NTIA. Luckily, there were plenty in attendance. So, why is the NTIA looking at this and why should we care? Well, Katie Masouris joined me via Skype to discuss vulnerability disclosure politics and ethics, and she pointed out that the current status quo that we've become comfortable with, doesn't really apply to a lot of, organizations like IoT vendors and car manufacturers and, other manufacturers of so-called smart things. The NTIA, she says, might actually wind up helping. But that doesn't mean things can't go wrong. So I started off by asking Katie if the ISO standard, an agreed industry norm, will partially insulate us from governments rolling in and slapping really daft regulations on things. So here's what she had to say.
So I became involved with the ISO standard that was already in progress when I joined Microsoft. And that was essentially initially a mission to make sure that that effort way back, a decade ago almost, that effort didn't repeat, previous mistakes in vuln disclosure and cause harm. So that was how I initially became involved in the ISO standard. And then through the work of a number of different subject matter experts, we got that thing to a state where it could be published in early 2014. So that is how I became involved in ISO.
Now, I would think this ISO thing, because I distinctly remember sitting in a bar with you in Rotterdam something like 6 years ago, and we were talking about this ISO standard, and I was just sitting there sort of shaking my head, just going, I don't know why you bother with this, like, what's the point? But now we get here in 2015, and I would hope that an ISO standard is going to insulate us from maybe governments forming stupid regulations, criminal sanctions, and putting the liability in the wrong place when it comes to when disclosure goes wrong. How much does the ISO standard actually insulate us from that scenario?
Well, there's a couple of issues that was brought up in the NTIA process that are valid around that ISO standard. And the first of which is that, you know, organizations have to pay to download that ISO standard. So it only defines what vendors should do, because I've never met a hacker who strives for ISO compliance. That is not a goal usually. So it's scoped strictly to how vendors should prepare to receive vulnerability reports and communicate with the friendly hacker and get the issue resolved and then release an advisory. And that's essentially what's in that ISO standard. But I think NTIA was trying to address the fact that it wasn't free and open. Now, that can potentially be changed, but I don't think NTIA really knew that when they embarked upon this process.
So really, it might just be a matter of making this standard available. What is the process to make that available?
Well, you know, we're working on it. Myself and Art Mannion from CertCC are the co-editors of an early revision of that standard. So we're going to be working on expanding certain areas that were not as well developed in the original standard, like multi-vendor vulnerability coordination. And I can go into that, you know, in more detail a little bit later. But so we're actually trying to find that out. We have an ISO meeting coming up at the end of this month, end of October, and we'll be finding out more about that process. But it's, you know, my personal determination to make sure that we make that standard free and available. And to that end, you know, the contents of that standard are summarized already in a YouTube video. It's a 20-minute YouTube video that's been out there for a couple of years now that I recorded about that standard, which is ISO 29147, and an accompanying standard, ISO 30111. And so the contents are kind of out there, but the written standard itself is not free and available yet.
Now, if we just wind back the clock a little bit and talk about what's happened with the Vassanar arrangement, you know, there are some people out there that are arguing that the, you know, sort of researchers and hackers' reticence to get involved in policy discussions is the reason that we've wound up with what a lot of people are arguing is pretty shitty policy in the form of the Vassanar arrangement and the way that it's been implemented around the world. You know, some places have done a better job than others. Do you think, though, that if researchers don't pile in to this current discussion that's happening around vulnerability disclosure, that we could wind up with some silly laws, some silly sort of criminal penalties, maybe even some silly liability distribution when it comes to the way these things are handled by civil courts? Basically, what I'm wondering is, could we get into a situation where the vendors, because, you know, hackers aren't contributing to this conversation, where the vendors wind up seizing all of the power when it comes to the way that vulnerabilities are disclosed?
Well, okay. So first, I think the NTIA is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. So they actually can't change the laws themselves. Well, can't regulate.
I'm not necessarily talking about the NTIA here. I mean, I'm just sort of, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, the NTIA, people are sort of doing a bit of an eye roll and sort of ignoring it. But this is what happens every time a discussion about vulnerability disclosure comes along. People have been ignoring it. And I'm just wondering if that is injecting a level of risk into the landscape that could bite us on the ass later.
Well, there's always a level of risk when these things are brought up again, as you pointed out. And I think that was one of the reasons why I agreed to become involved in the ISO standard process, because certainly my, you know, aspirations as a child were not, gee, I really want to work on ISO standards. So there, you know, I had the motivation to prevent bad outcomes from these types of activities. So you're spot on that there's always a risk there. I think that there are a lot of folks who are actually arguing the researchers' side. So myself, obviously, you know, also folks from Rapid7, Jen Ellis is also doing some amazing work in that space across the board, not just with NTIA, but also with, you know, proposed revisions to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act here in the United States, and a number of other different items, including Vassanar arrangement. So I think there are some researchers who are active researchers who are engaging. And then there are also some folks like myself and Jen Ellis from Rapid7 and others who are representing the research community, even though we are part of the vendor community technically, but we're vendors who deal in security research and find that to be worth protecting.
So what I don't get, right, is the status quo that we've settled on, and this is why I'm so over talking about vulnerability disclosure. The status quo seems to work actually pretty well, right? What you've usually got is a situation where someone might disclose a bug, you know, if they're dicks about it. Usually someone goes apoplectic at the vendor and they find some sort of obscure law, like, you know, the copyright law pertaining to pianola rolls or something, you know, and they'll use that to try to you know, jam up a researcher. It's inconvenient for them and they sort of get a whack for it and, you know, press articles ensue and blah, 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 and we have this conversation again. Everyone seems to kind of understand where the norms are. When a vendor gets too heavy-handed, as was the case with FireEye in Germany recently, you know, there's a lot of bad PR and it doesn't do them very well. But there's no real criminal sanctions. There's a lot of flexibility in the way this stuff plays out, and it seems to have settled into a nice status quo. So why do we even need to look at this? Why can't we just leave it alone?
Well, I think one of the things that came out of the initial NTIA meeting was exactly that question. It's number one, there's already standards. Number two, even with the standards, you know, the norms as they are, you know, things that people are used to dealing with. And so what came out of that as one of the potential areas to focus on in subsequent meetings with NTIA is the idea of driving adoption and awareness of the existing standards and the existing norms, because we're, you know, we've got a whole bunch of vendors who have been doing this for a long time, some of them better than others, but you've got a whole slew of new vendors who are adding, you know, code to devices that never had code before. So you've got your whole IoT situation of new vendors who are barely able to scratch the surface of writing secure code, let alone handling vulnerabilities. And for that, that seems to make sense to have a conversation for their benefit, but to drive adoption and awareness of existing norms and practices, especially when it comes to handling vulnerabilities that are reported to you and not seeking legal action as your first motivation.
So could we see, though, and this is what I wonder, now that this is up with the NTIA, you know, if the NTIA release something completely derp and say, you know, really, we think there's legislative reform needed here. We think that there needs to be X, Y, and Z, and come out with a bunch of really stupid ideas. Could we actually wind up, you know, spinning off into somewhere dangerous? Or do you think really what this is about is this is just a government department trying to wrap its head around the status quo?
I think there's a little bit of that going on, but you know, there are actually a couple of things that are worth talking about. So like I said about how Art Mannion and I are, you know, co-editors of the early revision of the ISO standard. The reason we would like to do that is to, you know, clean up some of the language in there, make it a lot easier for people to understand and apply, but also talking about two specific scenarios that haven't really been well defined. And those are multi-vendor coordination across a software, hardware, and services supply chain. So think of that as your mobile ecosystem as an example of that. You've got all of these different vendors involved in terms of what
you can say Android. You don't have to say mobile ecosystem. You can say Android.
No, it's actually all of them, though. I mean, Apple to a less extent because they have more control over their hardware, yeah. But they also have an entire developer community. So let's say there was a library issue in the underlying, you know, in some of the underlying APIs that all the developers had to use. You still have a multi-stakeholder vulnerability coordination that involves multiple vendors.
Yes,
so that's one
right.
scenario. Yeah. Yeah, so that's one scenario where that applies across all mobile ecosystems, that kind of scenario. Plus, remember, you've also got the carriers who would have to push the patches out, et cetera, and who shoulders the burden of cost of doing that and support costs if you brick a phone. So those are all unsolved problems in vulnerability coordination across that ecosystem. The other big area that is still, you know, kind of an open-ended problem is the Heartbleed type of scenario where you've got one commonly used library across, you know, the entire ecosystem, and you have to do, you know, a multi-vendor embargoed coordination of deployment. So
that one worked beautifully, right? Like that was a case where, I mean, didn't it?
Well, you know, it did and it didn't, right? They were all coordinating and it was over 100 different organizations who were coordinating, but it actually ended up going out earlier than the original planned date and everybody did have to roll fast.
Wasn't that just because someone else found it as well?
No, I think that was because I think there was some kind of trigger finger situation on a blog or whatnot. But the point is, it's complicated to coordinate across that many organizations, but sometimes you have to for internet safety. So there are those two kinds of, you know, open problems in vuln coordination and disclosure that are worth talking about at this point. But are they more high order?
Are they solvable, though? I mean, when you're talking about, you know, coordinating across 100 different organizations, I mean, you're going to have some that are going to lag. You've got the risk of information leakage, you know. I mean, is this something that we really need to work harder to understand? I mean, we've been doing it a long time.
Well, I think that the prevalence of those issues affecting more and more organizations that don't know how to do it necessarily, right? Mm. So you've got Chrysler. Organizations. Yeah, exactly. You've got different maturity levels. And that's actually what I presented at the NTIA meeting was a vulnerability coordination maturity model, because we've seen maturity models work in other areas of software security. You know, there's an SDL maturity model, there's the BSIM, you know, and so having this ability for organizations, whether they're doing vulnerability disclosure or not, to kind of take an assessment across their capabilities, see where they are now and see what the roadmap is for them getting better. And one of those things, you know, would be eventually getting to the place where they could do multi-vendor coordination. Not all of them can handle even a single, you know, vulnerability from a researcher, let alone multi-vendor coordination. So there's stepping stones and a roadmap there to be had.
Mm. So I guess really this NTIA thing is less about opening up a can of worms and trying to reestablish the norms, and more about trying to figure out how best apply the norms to other sectors of, you know, industries that are now sort of have inadvertently become technology companies, you know?
Well, that's exactly how I would like to see the NTIA process applied. I don't know if that's how it's going to turn out, but that's certainly the direction I'm pushing it, and some other folks are pushing it as well. Worst case scenario is that we spend another 15, 20 years wanting to kill ourselves because we're having the same conversation. That is the worst case. But the best case scenario is that we actually move on to awareness, adoption, making sure that none of what comes out of that does any harm to the research community, and focusing on those more complex, higher order vulnerability coordination issues.
Now, Katie, before I go, I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't ask you about the Microsoft lawsuit. You have launched a class action lawsuit against Microsoft alleging discrimination based on gender. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
There's nothing more I can talk about on that front. But, you know, I appreciate you asking.
All right. Well, Katie Masouris, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about vulnerability disclosure, the world's most exciting topic.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
That was Katie Masouris of HackerOne there. Big thanks to her. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Rocky Scopoletti. This week's show is brought to you by Telstra. Telstra is Australia's incumbent telco, so it's best known for its network services, but it's also a big player in enterprise services through its, you know, Telstra Enterprise Services division. And it's made some really substantial investments in mobile security lately. It's taken a stake in Zimperium, that's the company that Joshua Drake works for, and another called Telesign. So they're really looking at device security and, you know, cell network-based reputation stuff. These aren't half-assed investments. Telstra is taking this stuff seriously. So this week's sponsor guest is, as I said, Rocky Scopoletti. He's essentially Telstra's finance sector brain. He's not a security guy. He is definitely their finance sector expert. His title is Banking, Finance and Insurance Executive with Telstra Global Enterprise Services. And he recently dropped this report about the fusion between the finance industry, mobility and identity. That's actually pretty interesting reading. He publishes these annual reports that guide Telstra's investment decisions. And he's a very, very smart chappy. Now, if you work in finance, you really do need to read this report. He's directly linked trust in an institution to adoption of their services, or willingness of consumers to adopt their services. And from there, he's linked security features to trust. So if you want some ammo at your next board meeting, this is a PDF you really want to download. And there is a link to it in this week's show notes. Now, the upshot is Rocky says mobile devices are now the chosen way for consumers to interact with their financial institution. And that's a trend that's largely being driven by generational change. Gen X and Gen Y users think differently about authentication as well. They don't want to be using usernames and passwords in mobile apps, and nor should they, really, in this day and age, Rocky says. Now, he acknowledges the drawbacks with things like biometrics, but, you know, argues pretty convincingly that basically anything is better than usernames and passwords these days. He argues mobile security and trust should be top priority issues at financial institutions if they aren't already. Rocky Scopoletti, join me via phone for this interview. Here's what he had to say.
So there were two parts to the research, Patrick. The first part was really to garner industry perspectives. And so here we had 318 financial services executives contribute to the research from Asia Pacific, Europe and the United States. And these executives ranged in roles from chief executives to chief information security officers to CIOs to CTOs to heads of businesses. And the purpose of that part of the research was to really understand from their own enterprise perspective the role that identity security and privacy plays and how they're thinking about those aspects of their business going forward. The other part of the research involved a fairly significant quantitative study of consumer attitudes towards identity across the countries of Australia, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Hong Kong, UK and United States. And the underlying hypothesis in the research was that generations X and Y have profoundly changed how they prefer to be identified, and that mobile technology was playing a major role in that. And that was certainly proven throughout the research.
Now, what I find most interesting about this is, you know, I spend all of my time in security land. And, you know, a lot of what is in the report is quite intuitive, but it's the context in which the research is presented that I actually found most interesting, because really it seems like there's a massive shift going on in the financial services industry in particular, where people are generally starting to use mobile devices to interact with their financial services. In fact, I remember, in 2004, checking out a talk by the CEO of Salesforce in San Francisco, and he was saying when they made their mobile clients available for BlackBerry, you know, the transaction volumes actually went through the roof. So this is something that's been proven time and time again. People will generally go to mobile. But in this context, what's happening is financial services, you know, incumbents are starting to see a genuine risk from what you guys are calling sort of pure play online financial services organizations. I mean, how much of a issue is this in the financial services industry?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the compelling event, because we, in 2014, crossed a very significant inflection point in the sector, where for the first time in 18 of the 22 countries that I looked at, we are now using our mobile devices as the primary means of accessing financial services. And in that sort of new mobile-first world, we're now starting to see mobile-only players emerge in terms of providing financial services. So, for example, in the United States, we've already seen a major movement of people towards mobile-only financial services players. In the fintech side of the sector, we can now start seeing disruption occurring across many parts of the financial services environment, such as payments, being able to use your mobile device to make a payment instead of plastic. So we're seeing sort of disruption now really play out in terms of the mobile device. And this is what we mean about, in a mobile-first financial services world, we need to think completely differently. Now, in the context of security, the opportunity that we now have is to completely rethink the trust paradigm and shift it away from making people prove who they are through random pieces of information such as user ID and password onto technologies that recognize them for who they are. Because this whole sort of notion of user ID and password has not kept pace with our behavior digitally. So our digital behavior have outstripped the conventions of identity that we've used for digital development so far. And you can really see that, Patrick, playing out in the in the numbers associated with identity theft. One in three people, for example, globally and here in Australia, have been impacted by identity theft. 40% of those people blame the financial institution for being at fault for that identity theft. 65% of those people are now likely to leave the institution as a result of that event. And so the point that I make here is that identity theft has now become one of the single most important reasons of why people are going to leave an institution, and trust has now become the single most important reason of why Generations X and Y are going to select one institution over another.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting development, because at the moment there's some organisations who are doing some very, very clever things with their apps, with their mobile apps. But on the other hand, there are some organisations who are doing some very, very foolish things with their apps. So, you know, you say that there's this seismic shift on right now and a big rush to mobile in financial services. And the idea being that it's more convenient for the user. Look, and I know my bank's app, sometimes instead of logging in through a browser, quite often I will just use the app on my iPhone because it's easier to use. But I mean, where are you sort of advising people? How are you advising people to consider the security implications of this? Because, you know, in a lot of ways you can do things better on mobile, but there's all sorts of risks there that aren't really well understood as well. So what's the feeling like in financial services when it comes to the risks that the shift to mobile carry?
So what was interesting here, I think, and I think my research was really the first published report to show the relationship between how satisfied people are with their institutions' identity and security systems, and how prepared they are to be an advocate for that institution. And in fact, the two are correlated to about 98%.
Wow.
And so what we then looked at was then, well, okay, how are institutions performing against those two measures? And this is where we found a wide degree of variation amongst institutions on their performance against those two. Now, the standout in this is an organization called USAA in the United States. They have the highest level of satisfied customers using their identity and security systems, and they have the highest level of advocacy of any of the institutions that we studied. Now, what's interesting with USAA is that in the last 12 months, they've launched applications based on facial recognition, iris recognition, voice recognition, second factor authentication. They've got the full spectrum of options. And what else is really interesting is the constituents to whom USAA serve. They serve the military personnel of the United States who are dispersed in some of the most troubled parts of our globe. And so those constituents, you would argue, are probably the most informed and the most sensitive towards security-related matters. So the point is this: you can absolutely make a difference in your customer experience by including mobile-based identity and security systems, because those are the things that people feel more confident in when they engage their financial institution. Now, when it comes to looking at different institutions, what we also looked at in the research is who do people trust? And here, the respondents could select from a very broad range of different organisations. Now, financial institutions came up number one in every country that we studied, other than in Singapore. In Singapore, people trust the government more than they trust anybody else.
It's a funny little place, that, in some ways, isn't it?
It is. So here's the point. The point is that financial institutions today have more trust compared to any other organisational type. And so this is a place of privilege that they have with people.
But hang on, that's almost contradicting something you said earlier, which is that, you know, they've experienced ID theft and they're likely to you know, justify leaving an institution as a result of that. So on one hand, they're these trusted institutions. On the other, they keep losing people's information and saying, grr, I'm gonna hoof it over to the competition. So there's a bit of a disconnect there, isn't there?
Well, it's actually not. It's actually quite connected, because when we looked at yes, on a relative basis, people trust institutions more than they trust anybody else, but less than one in two are satisfied with their institution's current performance. So it's sort of the best of.
So they're selecting financial institutions as the least worst when it comes to privacy and security, I guess.
That's probably another way of framing it. And so here's the point, is that, again, trust is perishable. And so although today you might have more of it than any other organizational type, it is something that gives you a point of differentiation in a world that is being continuously disrupted by new entrants and new players.
This is really where I get interested, is you're saying there's a direct correlation between the level of trust that people feel for an institution when it comes to finance. So there's a direct correlation between the level of trust they feel, and it seems that the more security features you throw at them, the more they feel that they can trust that institution. So there's a correlation between that and adoption of that player's services. Now, in the InfoSec field, you know, people have been trying to tie security to business value for a very long time, and they've never actually really been able to prove it very well. So are you saying that InfoSec secure authentication, or I should more accurately say the perception of secure authentication, is actually driving adoption of services, that it's a moneymaker now?
Oh, look, absolutely. And so here's the thing. I wish I had a dollar for every time I've heard a product manager or a marketer in a financial institution say to me, we have to take the friction out of the user experience. Now, what we showed in the report was that that's perhaps an incomplete line of thinking, because what we need to be asking is, what are you prepared to trade off in order to have a more frictionless experience through your application? And what the results show is certainly not at the expense of security, and absolutely not at the expense of privacy. And so here's the thing, you absolutely can create a deeper relationship with your customers by providing them with greater degrees of confidence. Because when it comes to trust, what we identified in the research was, what does trust mean? And trust means four things: trust to keep my finances secure, trust to keep my personal information secure, trust to keep private the interactions I have with the institution, and then lastly, the reputation of the institution as a whole when it comes to security. They have now become the four most important reasons of why a Gen X or Gen Y is going to choose one institution over another. And so, you know, when it comes to thinking about your relationship, most of us here in Australia have many different relationships with different financial services providers. And the opportunity is to think about how you can create greater degrees of confidence in your user experience, that customers will spend more with you. Mm. And that's, again, through advocacy and showing the relationship between a person's propensity to be an advocate for your institution and how satisfied they are with your identity and security systems.
All right, Rocky Scopoletti, that is all really, really interesting stuff. I'm going to drop a link into this week's show notes so that people can read that report. And I suspect that there will be quite a few listeners who will be able to use this report in the boardroom. So I'm guessing there's a few security types out there who are going to be able to print this off and then wave it around at the next board meeting and say, hey, you know, look, there's science here that says we should be doing this. So, all really interesting stuff. Really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll have occasion to chat to you again in the future. Rocky Scopoletti, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
That was Telstra's Rocky Scopoletti there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Telstra for sponsoring this week's episode of the Risky Business Podcast. You can dig that report out of this week's show notes. I've left a link in there for you all. I hope you get some good reading out of that. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by a really awesome Sydney-based rapper who calls himself El Fresh the Lion. He's Aussie-born and bred, a proud Sikh, and his music zeroes in on growing up brown in Australia. It's about the experience This track, I guess, is about the experience of families who come here and slave their guts out to make it in a new place. And his music, you know, it comes from his story and the story of people like him, and it's great stuff. KRS-One actually did a intro rhyme to this guy's new album and says of El Fresh that, quote, he is hip-hop. This music has a lot of heart. And he also has a beard that puts Metal Storms to shame. Sorry, dude, but it is true. So here is El Fresh the Lion with his latest single, Get Mine. I'll drop a link through to his website in this week's show notes. I do hope you enjoy this track. Until a few weeks from now, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I'm reminded that I'm still a second-class citizen. They tell me to go home, but I come from here. I can see it in their eyes, they don't want me here. They tell me to play high, but the game ain't fair. Given a level playing field, I make a rain out here. We were running a race, and you gave me a handicap. I turn around and have one of my legs attached. They say you set it up for me the best you could. That ain't justice, winning on justice, good. We've been waiting, but man, it's a long line. And when we ask, it's always the wrong time. They say, this is yours, but what's yours is mine. But yeah, I gotta get mine. And villages where when people disappear, they ain't no witnesses. We came up from the dust to manifest riches here. So excuse my smile when they try to tell me what struggle is. Cause we saw it all when we came here. Worked the jobs to feed the seed to make a name here. Never been a slave to the game, but to change it, you need links to break the chains here. I ride or I drive to make a lane here, but I'm thankful my own kids to be raised here. They'll build a dynasty for what I made here, but to then I'ma be stuck with the same deal. Working all day and night. And then they're never giving up the fight. They see me fall back up till I get mine. Hey! Hey! Trying to stay sane, playing the game that they give us. Them I ask what we want, but they never really listen. We would never feel changed, so we change the system. And I try to be part of it, but lost my heart in it. Try to get by without being targeted. When we make our own and work our backs up, there's no Vaseline when the man wants more. That's cool. I rise in the game with a flame. That's cool. My back's too strong for the cane. That's cool. Why do I gotta explain? Everyone is a chance to be truly the same. That's cool. My people never bigger than these. That's cool. We would never die for the cheese. That's cool. We would rather break the trap and never fake the rap till the day that I'm gone. We've been waiting, but man, it's so long line. Ask, it's always the wrong time. They say, this is yours, but what's yours is mine. But yeah, I gotta get mine.